Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
Serena Patrick's presentation, lung transplant, a new lease on life after COVID-19. So welcome back. And Serena, thank you very much. Looking forward to the talk.
Thank you. And I feel very fortunate. Dr. Somai may be picking on you a little bit during this presentation, so we'll make it through together. So first I want to talk about why do we transplant patients. So indications according to the ISHLT are for advanced end-stage pulmonary diseases such as ILD, COPD, pulmonary hypertension, and cystic fibrosis. In addition to having a high, which is greater than 50% risk of death within 2 years, and high, greater than 80% likelihood of survival at least 90 days after surgery, and high, greater than 80% likelihood of a 5-year post-transplant survival with adequate graft function. What we've learned is with more experience, we've gotten better at selecting our patients. Would you agree?
Yes.
We're going to talk about some contraindications for lung transplant. As you notice, some of them are going to be bolded and highlighted. These are things that we're going to start discussing when we talk about lung transplant in COVID patients. So some absolute contraindications are malignancy. So that is a recent history for some centers of at least 2 years cancer-free. That's for non-melanoma skin cancers. Most centers will prefer 5 years cancer-free for sarcomas, melanomas, and breast cancers. Poorly controlled significant dysfunction of other organs, such as the heart, kidney, liver, or brain. This is going to be very important when we start looking at patients who were selected and transplanted after they had COVID-19. Unstable medical conditions such as sepsis, MIs, or liver failure, irreversible bleeding disorders, poorly controlled infections such as COVID, functionally limited when you're talking about patients who have been in the hospital for a very long time and immobile. And then, of course, obesity, like we spoke about earlier, which is a BMI greater than 35. Relative contraindications for lung transplant include age, greater than 65. Some centers are a little bit more friendly than others, but typically we will not go above the age of 75. Mechanical ventilation and or ECMO. For those patients, we need to be very selective in who we consider, and they must have no acute or chronic other in-organ failure. Coronary artery disease, which could cause in-organ failure after transplant, so we need to consider the extent of that CAD and what type of stent they've had. Other diseases that are not well controlled, such as diabetes, GERD, hypertension, or epilepsy, significant osteoporosis, or significant malnutrition. So some of the factors that we look at when we're looking at organ allocation for the lung is going to be both the survival benefit on top of medical urgency, their waiting time, distance from the donor hospital, and if they're for children, their pediatric status. So this is what I'm going to pick on you a little bit. So this is going to be a time for reflection. This is a statement from OPTN or the UNOS Ethics Committee. Because donated organs are a severely limited resource, the best potential recipient should be identified. The probability of a good outcome must be highly emphasized to achieve the maximum benefit for all transplants. So my question is, how do we, in the transplant field, select how we're going to move forward? Who is the best candidate because these organs are so scarce?
Can I add one more thing to it? would you consider differentiating between regular and DCD?
Again, those are very good questions. So let me just give you a historical perspective on how transplantation, and even if you look at the contraindications and the relative contraindications. If you look, when I started my training and got into transplantation was like 2009 to now, it's 11 years. When I started off, if you had a patient with HIV, if you had a patient with Hep C, if you had anybody who hit 60 mark, we would not transplant. Because at that juncture, the outcomes we weren't sure about, we did not know how to manage those patients and everything else. So, In a span of 10 years, if you look at, first thing, let's talk about age. If you look at 2019, almost 35% to 38% of the patients are 65 plus, and I think 12% are 70 plus. How did we reach this point? Cumulative accumulated experience and learning from it, and essentially identifying whom we can help and whom we cannot help. And going back, Hep C, it doesn't matter anymore. HIV with HOPAC, now we take actually donors with HIV positive and transplant them to HIV positive patients. So there's a lot of progress in that field. So when you start talking about probability of a good outcome, I think that's a perspective. As you know, HRSA had a very good intention in 2010. And that's something which we always like, why do we have a medical review board and it's not just like me as a medical director walking and say, oh, I want to get this patient transplanted. Because we do, as a group think you want to eliminate those individual biases and somebody to have an objective lens. Why would Dr. Hani come to an MRV meeting when we were in Houston Methodist? For somebody to look at objectively and say, hey, this has been our experience in general, this is what has been in our center, and this is what we have done well, and these are the patients we have not done not so well. I think that's where it comes into, and absolutely, especially in a COVID scenario, one, we need to ask our question is, does the patient need a transplant? So, which is where the natural evolution of the disease. Would I go ahead and jump on somebody who's on an ECMO, just had a COVID, and he's 10 days out? Probably not. That's not the timing to talk about transplant. I want to give him a reasonable time period before I say, oh, the guy has persistent ARDS, he has an irreversible injury, before I go and say, okay, now I want to talk about a lung transplantation. Now I've reached that juncture. Now where do I go? Like you pointed out, somebody on a vent and on an ECMO cannula paralyzed for 3 weeks. Yeah, we can replace the organs. You guys do it. You can put on cardiopulmonary bypass. You can look, make the numbers look good. You can take a heart out and keep somebody alive for 10 hours. But the game starts after you come off it. So same thing. If we do not think as a clinical judge, or essentially as a clinician, if I do not think there is a reasonable chance for that patient want to survive the surgery and have a reasonable outcome from there, then probably he's not the ideal candidate. And that's the thought process which comes into mind. And as you said, different teams, yeah, next week maybe a different attending, one of my colleagues will come in, maybe he'll have a different perspective on it. And that goes in, and that's the reason why we emphasize our, I kind of like that medical review board, a group of people to make the choice rather than individual biases, especially when you're taking care of a patient, there is a lot of bias which does come into interact with the family and everything, and you want people who are not directly involved in the patient care, but can give you an objective idea where we are. And I totally agree with it. Yes, can we transplant everybody with COVID? Absolutely not. We all know the answer. Yes, I'm sure there are certain people who will benefit from it. It's an evolution, very limited experience, which has been published so far. So let's see, it's a learning curve, and I learned a lot from mine, because we just looked at it a different aspect of what people have done so far, and we wanted to give it a shot. Touch wood, it has turned out good. So.
I want to ask you something about the length of time on the vent in and of itself. Since you're going to transplant that lung, how does that play in? In other words, if that lung has been on the vent for a very long time, but we're not going to have that lung anymore, right?
So that's a very good question. Dr. Hani must have seen it. So why do we transplant somebody? The two major indications is pulmonary fibrosis with interstitial lung disease, and next is COPD in United States. So who are the people who would be on a ventilator and potentially going for a transplant is more likely to be a guy with interstitial lung disease than flare-up, what we call an acute exacerbation, which actually majority of times can happen in a non-infectious context. That's just a primary inflammatory process which has driven it. Would I transplant somebody on a ventilator, probably, especially an ET tube? Probably not. Because especially would I evaluate a patient on an ET tube? Probably not. That's just fine, because I strongly believe, again, that's as a physician and as a transplant professional, that the patient needs to be involved in that decision. This is not cardiopulmonary. This is not doing a bypass surgery. You do a surgery, everything is hunky-dorky, and they go home. This is something, the surgery is one part. It's a life-changing decision. And after that, the patient has to be involved in it, and it's his choice. He has to make the choice. Is it something I want to take? I've met people who said, Doc, you know what? I don't think this is for me, and I absolutely respect the decision. They have to be in it. The way I tell my patients, it's not like a Black Friday sale. You ran to Walmart, got something, and you woke up on Saturday morning and decided, nah, I don't want it. Let me go back again. Mm-hmm. Transplant ain't that. You have to stick to it.
So we're going to look at COVID-19, their current numbers and its effects. So as of yesterday, September 11th, there was over 6 million people in the United States who have been diagnosed with COVID-19. As of yesterday, there was 191,000 people in the U.S. who have died from COVID-19. as we know, it's impacted many of our industries, especially in the healthcare field. It's really changed the way that we've had to provide healthcare. Dr. Samir's favorite, we've now leaned heavily on telemedicine. For us as nursing, it's really changing how we're having to screen patients both before and after, even when they're coming into clinic appointments, before the transplant surgery. And then as we discussed about earlier, working with limited resources. So we did have some periods where there weren't enough ECMO machines. How do you select who moves forward with transplant? So COVID-19 in our lung transplant recipients. So we're gonna discuss a case of a 30-year-old male who was post-lung transplant, and he contracted COVID 1 year after his transplant surgery. Now he was the first lung transplant recipient that received convalescent plasma for COVID-19. Now that's plasma which is enriched with antibodies to help fight the virus, and that's coming from a previously infected patient. So he was febrile in the ICU with failing kidneys. And within hours after receiving the plasma infusion, his fever started decreasing. Days later, his breathing became easier and his kidney function improved. On day number 9 after the infusion, he actually tested negative for COVID-19. He was released home on May 1st and he continues to test negative. Now, I heard you said that you all have used the convalescent plasma.
Yes, actually, it's part of the trial which is going on in Memorial Hermann as a system. Yes, everybody gets convalescent plasma. Mm-hmm.
I think for me, anecdotally, again, everything for me is anecdotal. I'm in a community hospital setting. I'm not in an academic center. I think it's mixed. Oh, my. No.
Once again, I'm coming at this from a community-based setting versus academic center, and so my observations are very anecdotal. I think some people seem to respond well to it, and others have no response to it at all.
Absolutely. I mean, that's as there are different ways of looking at it, essentially. One way would be, I don't want to say it, but someday it's a groundbreaking thing. I don't know, but even if you look at the data, at least people are coming in, especially from China and Italy. The concentration of the antibody, how higher the titers are, that plays a role. Do we take everybody who has IgG positive and infuse it? Maybe, maybe not. Again, it's similar to what something, a viral infection like, say, influenza. Yeah, we all develop antibodies to it, but doesn't mean it protects you. Maybe not. You need something more. You need a cellular response. Maybe it's a combination of both of them. So we don't know. Yes, that's something which has shown, but again, in the biggest trial which has been done, the reason why even NIH was very hesitant to endorse it was the rush to try different treatments and the pool got muddy. It never became, yes, no convalescent serum. It just became, yes, convalescent serum plus A, B, C, D, D, and S, convalescent serum with just A and B, and yes, convalescent serum with just A. So it's very difficult to say that answer as of right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my opinion. Benign, definitely, in this current era, probably should be tried.
Yeah, it won't do harm.
Yeah.
We can agree on that, yeah. Yes. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So this 30-year-old patient was actually part of University of Chicago Medicine clinical trial. The trial recruited University of Chicago patients and other patients from the Chicago area who had recovered from COVID-19. So they previously had tested positive and are at home and recovered. So it is in the first phase, and it's being assessed as a treatment option for the critically ill patients, as those that have severe or life-threatening illness. The convalescent plasma is being used as a treatment option in China, New York, and then, as we hear, here in Houston. A single plasma donor can be used to treat multiple transfusion recipients. Once researchers have validated that it's safe and basically that it's valid and valuable, we're going to start looking at the effectiveness as a treatment option, as we just previously discussed.
Mm-hmm. So, and again, and forgive me, but I hope you don't mind. We
no,
have
it's
sort
okay.
of a free-flowing kind of deal here. We don't necessarily follow, you know, just not, you know, get all the lecture done. But, you know, I noticed that it was for those that were critically ill, those that were failing everything else, and then they get the convalescent plasma. And I have to scratch my head just a little bit and wonder, I mean, are we just waiting too long? Is it, you know, why do we wait until they, maybe we should prevent that something from happening?
This is in the trial, but in clinical reality, it's being given right now, not as a last resort.
It is. Mm-hmm. So it's being given early.
ARDS, essentially, anybody who's developing ARDS, he's actually getting it.
Okay, so you're, the trigger for giving it is early.
Well, and that also comes with the caveat that the two patients, at least we transplanted, as I was telling you, one got an infection somewhere in the middle of the month, went to the ER, got positive X-ray, was fine. 6 days or 7 days after the exposure, then goes back after a week later, now hypoxic and X-ray is different. So it took some time, where the other patient says, yeah, I went to a barbecue a week prior to that, and next time we went to the ER, he was hypoxic and X-ray shows again. Again, it's very difficult to predict how long it has been. All we know is from the point they contacted, had a contact with the healthcare facility, and the diagnosis has been made. Again, you see, I mean,
yes.
What happened prior to that, we don't know.
Yes.
It is not like an experiment we used to run in the lab. We have a mice, 1,200, I injected LPS, 1,800, I cut the mice down and took the spleen, or 2,400, I took the spleen out, and I know exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But there is so much uncertainty on it. When do we give it? It's very difficult. Again, it goes back to, it's like a old wine before antibiotics came in Second World War or anything. One of the treatments for infections was to give serum. That's what it used to be called, was take serum and give it. And all the infections which existed at that point of time, something simple like pneumonia from pneumococcus. One of the ways I'm sure Dr. Hani would have learned in his microbiology, the way we used to detect it is actually give plasma on it so the antibodies bind to the cell wall, and that's how you can visualize it, because antibody plays a big role in controlling how pneumococcus is cleared by the body. And the reason why we vaccinate people who don't have immune suppression or who don't have a spleen, because it helps you clear that. Does it expand to every known infectious agent? Probably not. So it's a pretty big unknown in that way. So we are just rehashing what has been done like 50, 60 years back and trying to put back.
Absolutely.
In. It's a great
basics
thought.
Basics of microbiology.
Yeah, it's a great thought, but we don't know, to put it that answer.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is not really, it's not like a drug, Gilead can ship it. So it's really the availability and blood donation centers. And it's a lot of work to get the convalescent plasma.
It's expensive.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's expensive to make.
Yes, and you have to have, it's like stem cells.
Yes.
You have to have a high yield.
Yeah.
You have to have a high yield of the antibody.
That's right.
Forgive me.
No, you're all right. So lung transplant for COVID-19. So back in May of this year, there was a patient that was successfully transplanted in Europe. It's an unnamed 45-year-old woman in Austria, and that was at Vienna Medical University and their general hospital. So she was previously in good health with no prior health conditions. This is a theme that you're going to see in the couple of patients that we're going to discuss about. However, her condition rapidly deteriorated. So another important and kind of a hot topic, her PCR test showed COVID particles were still present, but they felt that she was not actively infected. And that was confirmed with a negative viral culture. So like I said, she was the first transplant in Europe for lung damage caused by COVID-19. She also did have low platelet counts, which can be very dangerous going into a major transplant surgery. She also had antibodies present in her blood. That really takes the risk profile of a transplant up. So you have COVID-19 and now someone who has high levels of antibodies in her blood. So she required immune apheresis to prevent organ rejection, trying to lower those antibodies and get her successfully through the transplant surgery. However, they did report that surgery was very complicated, but it was successful. She did have a long recovery and they're hoping to get her discharged home. They are reporting that she's doing well and there's no major problems at this time. So this was the first one that I was able to find back in May.
So now let me ask you, Soma, what's the deal? What's the rejection situation with those lungs? Like, how are you going to manage the rejection meds? I know I'm asking a very heavy question. That is a controversy in every CMPI right now. You know, as you know, very, I'm sorry, sir, but you're smart. You're the smart guy. I have to ask you a question.
Oh, Lordy. You know, immune suppression, yes, broadly we know what we do. If you look at SRTR in the United States, we are heavy on, like, say, Prograf and giving Celsat or mycophenolate. That's our preferred dual agent. So if you look back, prior to this, there were a couple of studies which came from China. Obviously, they came from China. Nobody wants to talk about it. But if you look at the immune suppression, I'm not negating that aspect, but in general, it always needs to be taken with based on the history. But I'm sure they did a great job, actually, if you look at it. They are more cyclosporin-based. Our tendency, what we do as an immune suppression, there should be no change in regards to if it's COVID or non-COVID. It's very rare scenarios where the induction and what your initial strategy is any different. That's my opinion.
Well, let me ask you, if you get like right now an existing lung transplant patient is COVID positive, you change the rejection meds?
That's again is a very knee-jerk response, I honestly feel. Immune system both has a good way controlling infection, also a bad way where you can actually create inflammation just per se by itself. As of right now, with the limited clinical tools which we have, we cannot answer it in a clinically meaningful way. See, if somebody comes in with a severe pneumonia, he's leukopenic and everything else, probably at that juncture, I would rather actually increase the steroids and maybe hold the cell set because it does inhibit your lymphocyte proliferation and things like that. But again, it's very case to case. Would I alter it specifically because somebody has COVID? Absolutely not. I think infections are infections. You just control them.
So the second case we'll talk about is from June of 2020. This was a 28-year-old female who received a double lung transplant after contracting COVID-19. And this was also done in Chicago. So again, she was previously healthy with no serious underlying medical conditions, but she became critically ill due to COVID-19. Now this patient was actually in the hospital for 6 weeks prior to transplant, full life support, ventilated on ECMO, anything that you can think of, this is what she needed to get to this point for transplant. Now, weeks passed with no improvement, and they showed irreversible damage began starting to stress out her heart and her liver. So the decision was made to work her up and actually list her for transplant after she tested negative for the virus. She was only listed for a few days before she found her match and was transplanted. So she was actually the first known lung transplant, first known lung transplant for damage caused by COVID-19 here in the U.S. It was a 10-hour surgery, and it was more difficult due to the amount of inflammation from COVID-19, and it left the lungs stuck to the surrounding tissue, her heart, her chest wall, and the diaphragm. Her recovery was very rough. Her illness actually made the patient too weak to breathe, so she recovered on the vent until her strength returned. So imagine that. We talk about patients being too weak to walk. This patient was too weak to even breathe on her own, but we transplanted her, okay? Now she was released July 9th and is now not needing any supplemental oxygen. So Dr. Barat, which is the chief thoracic surgeon, felt that this was the patient's only chance of survival, but also states that lung transplant will not be an option for every patient who has damage due to COVID-19. He felt that patients should be young, relatively healthy, very functional in their past, with minimal or no comorbidities. Would you agree with this statement?
Yes, I do. I mean, now, we are talking about different things. As a patient, yeah, I probably would have not the ideal patient I want to try on something, especially when I have a novel disease I'm facing with. I mean, if you read about it, she was on a ventilator, she got ECMO support, had thoracotomies, chest tubes, just for the surgical aspect, she was a high risk. I'm sure she developed additions and things, which obviously they saw when they did the surgery. And I mean, as I always tell people, can the surgery be done? Yeah, absolutely. Transplant surgery is very well honed technique. You can do Absolutely. It on everybody. The thing is the patient going to make out from it? That's where the game starts. And I think one of the hunches was with her, she was young, very functional, and then probably that's what swayed the medical review board in Chicago. I cannot obviously second guess what their thought process was. I'm sure that played a big role, that she was young, and the chance of her recovering is a lot easier when you're 35 compared to somebody who's like 70.
Got a question. Did they know at the time prior to the surgery that the lung was attached to the heart and surrounding tissues like that, or that's something they found out?
Dr. Hani can comment. He has seen enough thoracic surgeries and
cardiothoracic surgeries. You can get all kinds of CAT scans that you want, but unless you get in there, see how stuck it is, how different the surgery is, a bit different. The section, this is what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you have to be prepared for that. And like, you know, Soma said, we have amazing surgeons that can handle the situation very well. And they getting to the surgery, I think, like you said, is the easiest part. What's going to happen after that? That's the most difficult part.
Yeah.
But you know, you taught me something today. Because I was looking at my brother CAT scans and saying, there's no way that lungs are going to recover. Lungs are going to recover. Okay. You know, see like a block, like, there's no one air cavity, and there's no way that lungs are going to recover.
I mean, as you rightly pointed out, anytime you violate the pleural space, either by a large bore chest tube or prior surgeries, pleuresis, or even a bypass surgery, and they developed a post-cardiotomy pleural effusion, inflammation will happen, and there will be adhesions between the pleural, visceral pleura and the parietal pleura. Always makes a big difficulty regarding dissecting a patient. Mm-hmm. Because unlike a bypass surgery, you open the sternum, the heart is sitting right there. When you do a lung transplant, it's like you have a small window and you're digging it out. So it really makes it a big challenge.
Well, that's why IPF is very much more difficult surgery than COPD surgery.
Right. Yeah.
So COPD is a chip shot. Mm-hmm. IPF, These guys be on standby for COPD. IPF needs pulmonary bypass at the time.
Yeah. Well, that's similar to like reoperations for cardiac reoperations. The fibrosis and the scarring and the adhesions.
Yeah.
It's just sometimes you can't even do all the grafts.
All the grafts
because you can't get it back out. So you encounter this type of thing where you have these adhesions around the lung.
Yeah, that's one of the
clinical. It's not that unusual. I mean, this might have been a severe case, but
yeah, it's not unusual. I'm as surprised that they saw it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's what we would have. Anybody, a reasonable team would know that mm-hmm. that's what they're going to face when they're going. Mm.
So in July of 2020, University of Chicago Northwestern Memorial Hospital actually completed their second transplant for COVID-19. Now, this was a 62-year-old male. He also was relatively healthy with no underlying conditions. He was transferred from an outside hospital to Northwestern Memorial for lung transplant consideration, where they worked him up. Now, this patient was on ECMO for 100 days. He was listed once he also tested negative and transplanted within 72 hours. It was another difficult surgery over 10 hours, and they found this time necrosis and mass inflammation once his chest was open. Now, a little bit different and also increasing this patient's risk profile, he had a previous major chest surgery at the other hospital for massive infection. Now, luckily, he was able to be extubated 24 hours after his transplant surgery, and this is actually a picture of his explanted lung.
I mean, that's almost unbelievable to me to hear that he was on ECMO 100 days. He's transplanted after being listed and transplanted within 72 hours of testing negative. And then he was extubated 24 hours after the transplant.
I'm looking at his picture, and he doesn't have a tracheostomy, so probably what he had was a single lumen on the IJ, and he just stayed on a VV ECMO and O2 supplementation non-invasive. That I can tell you.
Yeah.
And that I'm not surprised
he
about.
He wasn't previously too.
Yeah. I mean,
he wasn't on the vent.
But again, I'm just making an assumption looking at his picture and mm-hmm. his neck. Mm-hmm. I don't see a tracheostomy there. And especially
yes.
that's immediately after extubation from the surgery. But then he must have been bridged just with non-invasive ventilation and a VV ECMO, which I think is a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. I think so too. Because if he had been intubated for those 100 plus days,
then you start the sedation.
I don't believe that.
And then all
be,
the different stories start after that.
Look at that lung. That lung is not recoverable. I mean, there was not a recovery.
No, but that's what is that the entire lung or is that a section? Is that a lobe?
It's very difficult to say.
And did he have? You know, and is that from, how much contribution is that from the previous, you know, you said he had an empyema?
So he, it just said major chest surgery. They didn't go into.
I would think like,
so probably from an empyema. Again, remember, this is a deflated lung. It's not like an inflated lung.
Right.
Deflated lungs always are more smaller and bodier and things like that.
Okay.
So COVID-19 lung transplant patient takeaway point. While complicated, it can be done. It offers those with no other options a chance. It does take teamwork and a multidisciplinary approach, which we've talked about previously today, with the pulmonologist, surgeons, anesthesia, your intensivist, infectious disease. It won't be an option for every COVID-19 patient. Must be careful to make sure the virus is cleared before starting the immunosuppressants. You want to assess your patients for any other organ dysfunction, which may make transplant a contraindication. And the effect and results of transplant in this population are still unknown. Like we said, there's really not that many patients that have been done, so there's still more to see and see if it's safe and how they do after the transplant surgery, especially when you're talking about immunosuppressants. Are there more patients to come? So we must ask ourselves, will more transplant centers be willing to transplant COVID-19 patients? And how do we choose who to list?
That's it's very take back a step back. So I trained in India. I went to a hospital which was probably the only one which would actually refuse an admission of a patient if they did not have a bed, being a public hospital, so which was a big deal. So in my hospital, the only patients who got hemodialysis was people who were listed for a kidney transplant. Why did the hospital come to resource allocation? So their take was somebody has a living donor who's going to donate a kidney for this patient and he's matched, those are the people we will have willing to support and take that expense and go along with it. So we are talking about resources. So let's come back to US. Adequate resources, everything is there. why is transplantation supported by even, say, Medicare? It all stems down to from kidney transplant. You have 20-odd patients. It's more expensive to support a patient on hemodialysis than for them to get a kidney transplant. And there is cost saving across the board on all the organs, and actually the biggest ones are kidney and lung, lo and behold. If you have chronic lung disease and you simulate them, there's actually a paper which was published 4 years back, or 5 years back, actually. You actually save more money if a patient goes for a transplant evaluation. If he gets a transplant or not, it's a different story, compared to somebody who goes for usual care and wherever they are. So that's definitely there is a benefit. Now we come down to the pandemic and where we are. One of the often, if you look at ERJ, just published a editorial following up that COVID positive patient from Vienna whom they listed. And one of the questions, arguments which was made was when we already have difficulty accessing donors, is it justifiable to transplant these patients who have a post-acute illness? I think that argument becomes a little circumferential. I'm not a big believer in penalization. If that's the argument, then I can go and take the devil's advocate and say, why should I transplant a patient with emphysema? He knew smoking is bad for him. He knew he was taking a risk for COPD. Then why should I go and transplant? Then where does that argument stop? It can go to anywhere from there. Oh, I don't want to transplant a familial PF patient. No, I don't want to transplant a cystic fibrosis patient because that's his parents' fault. They had one copy of the gene and they gave it to the kid. Why should I transplant? It was their fault. So it's a very slippery slope ethically. As a physician, as a hospital, somebody walks into my ICU, these patients will not be any different from any other patient with acute or chronic severe lung disease or severe acute lung injury. I think that's my take. I think you should evaluate them similar to that. One, do they qualify for the treatment? And the next question, we all talk in a group, just because I have a hammer, does it mean I should go and start nailing something down? Is it an appropriate time? I think in that regards, we will be seeing more patients, absolutely, definitely. And probably as a group in the country, as I think people are going to do a lot more transplants, I'm sure, over the next few months to a year. And we'll start seeing, obviously, somebody will be pushing the barriers and going on it, and we'll see a lot more response essentially from it. I think, in my opinion, absolutely you should be. Like any other patients, you evaluate for a lung transplant, these patients should be evaluated the same way. That's my take on it.
Very good. Interesting.
What other risks are involved in transplanting patients like this?
So what I can say based on the experience we have and the two people we have, so why did we deliberately choose the patients I chose or as a group we chose to transplant? One, ambulatory, following all the, they made the decisions along with their families. They're participating in physical therapy. In spite of being bedbound and minimal exertion, one guy biked every day. He made it a point. He used a bike in his room and bike. The other guy was walking around on 100% non-rebreather, so they were still functionally active. Virgin chest, never have been undergone any sort of chest surgery, chest tubes or nothing of that sort. So those were the things which came into my consideration. If you ask me, had I met the patient from Vienna and had I met these two patients who were transplanted in Chicago and I was the first guy and I did not have any knowledge anybody has done it, I would say my answer would have been, I'm sorry, they're too sick to transplant. So I learned something. Yes, it can be done. Looks like patients have recovered from it. Is it because of the COVID virus? No, it was not because of the COVID virus, but on the day of the surgery where they were 2 to 3 months, being on ECMO, being on a ventilator, multiple surgeries, chest tube placement, that is the risk factors which I'm thinking about, not the COVID and everything else. So I think that's, again, going in future, that would still be my friend. And if you ask my surgeon too, probably that would be our question too. We don't want to take patients who have been in the hospital bedbound for a long period of time or ECMO or anything. I don't, as a group, we do not think the risk of doing a surgery on them is so beneficial, or the risk benefit is, I don't think it's so spectacular. Let me put that.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
What if you were to add in things like hypertension, diabetes, CKD?
Very good question. Diabetes, manageable. You can treat it as long as the patient is compliant. We have excellent for type 2 and type 1. So as I always tell people, chronic medical problems are chronic medical problems. There will be, if somebody comes in, especially in this case, like one of the issues we had, We have a very stringent dietitian who always believes everybody should have a hemoglobin A1C less than 7. If a patient is 2 months and receives steroids, there is no way even a normal person hemoglobin A1C would be 8 and 10. So that's, again, it's something we induced insulin intolerance by an active infection, by the treatment which we gave, and probably the chronic immobility which we caused in this patient. Is it something which is irreversible? Absolutely not. Is it something which can be worked upon? Yes. And that's my philosophy. If I go on, the way I want to look at it, or my philosophy would be, these are all chronic issues. It's never A to B to C to D. These all run simultaneously, and that's why transplant is such a multidisciplinary practice, because you need all the different people and you do all of them simultaneously. You don't wait for, I'm going to wait for the hemoglobin A1C to normalize, then I'm going to talk about what it is. Same thing with CKD. Once you hit CKD stage 3 or even 4, you need to think about it, because you can induce AKI, and higher chance they may end up on dialysis, which you want to prevent. Depends on your surgeon. Some people do an excellent job of not pre-inducing AKI. As Dr. Hani can say, every cardiothoracic surgeon has his unique signature, which you see in the labs. And so some are more kidney friendly and some are not. So that's the way I would, I think.
I think we find that in perfusion too.
I'm sure.
Our perfusion technique makes a huge difference. I think I was going to mention this during your talk too. I think when we sit there and run hemoglobins of 6 and 7, and we're not transfusing those patients, notwithstanding transfusions have their own morbidities associated with them.
I have risks and complications. I understand. It's almost in my mouth. I mean, seriously, I can't have it any further, any closer. I'll speak up. But I think very low hematocrits, low DO2, just exacerbates an already existing problem. So when we put patients on pump, Surgeon A, you know, let's keep the hemoglobin higher on this patient. They have a little underlying AKI. They do well. The other surgeon is like, we're going to do it just like we always do it on everybody else. And the hemoglobin is 5.96. And those patients have worsening AKI when the operation is over.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So now we see that too.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
For those patients who have recovered from COVID-19, have you seen any lasting effects?
So this is, again, as I told you, we are just 9 months into it. All we can predicate, people, obviously, the biggest thing, we have a data on who passed away or who succumbed to it. We don't have much information on who are the people recovered. The one offhand, my experience I've directly dealt with, one was a post-transplant patient, young kid, hung out and had a party in Beaumont, developed COVID, coughed, had a fever for a day. We watched him for 3 days and went home. And we see him IgG positive on. Couple of ILD patients pre-transplant who were developed it, and God bless them. I think they actually did very well. So how do we follow them up? I still don't have any.
Yeah, we want to cheat from you, me and Serena, because I know what we're gonna follow up. And so do you want to get CAT scans on your patients post? You know what I'm talking about? Do you want to get echoes?
Echo for what?
So I'm just asking you, we have a mandate on us. Uh-huh. So do you want to get CAT scans and follow-up echoes?
But again, since it's unknown, do we want to do it as a mass and mass right now and see from it, one, we don't know what the risk is. As Joe used a word, very nice, we are all pontificating based on our accrued medical knowledge and our own thought behind it and what we have. We think should be the optimal way of it. If somebody is doing it as a process, even in ERJ, Dr. Ganesh Raghu actually was a primary author on it. He's an ILD guru, I agree, but he had this schedule he wanted to follow, or he recommended for people to follow. That again is probably just, it's like having a road and having a divider in the middle. One guy to stick to the right and the other guy come to the left, because at least it gives you a guidance and a structure, something later on you can downplay. If you ask me, absolutely, do you need an echo as a clinician? I would say probably not. But in a bigger picture, you're following them up and you want to see how they're evolving. Absolutely, why don't you? Later on, you can always look back and down titrate it.
PFTs.
My question. So should they follow a pulmonologist?
If does everybody who has a run-of-the-mill should go into a pulmonologist? Probably not. But again, limited data, even at 3 months, people report that they are having symptoms. Does that symptom just translate from the fact they had a bad viral infection, or they truly have some sort of pulmonary physiological impairment? It's very difficult to say. Whom would I like to see? Absolutely, if anybody has been discharged, I think it's a good idea to see a pulmonologist. Probably we are, it's not like we are any smarter than anybody else, but probably we are more focused, and it's a primarily a respiratory ailment. So we can give the judgment call to see how people are doing and study radiologically, physiologically with a PFT, see if there are any abnormalities or not.
And then will the damage continue to the point where these patients may need a lung transplant and get to come and see us?
It's a common, we probably are going to wrap up our paper in the next week or two, doing a lot of immune histochemistry on it, because our lab where we collaborate with, and we are intensely focused on idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So one of the questions we wanted to look at is what we are seeing in this persistent ARDS, is it post-COVID ARDS fibrotic changes? Does it actually mimic IPF? So if that's the case, can we do some treatment options on these people who still require a lot of oxygen 1 month and 2 months out? It's an emerging story. I haven't seen the slides myself for the last week. They were stained, so next week hopefully we'll have some answer. But I'm sure I'm going to keep you guys in the loop, because I am, as a scientist, I am really excited to look at those explanted lungs. The reason being, unvarnished, no ECMOs, no ventilator, and all the super added inserts which can change the primary lung pathology as such pathologically. So these are like what I call pristine progression of ARDS. And unfortunately for both of them, it remained persistent, whatever that inflammatory change was. And when we looked at the HNE slides, you can see nice microvascular abscesses where the just lungs look like just lysed itself off because it got infarcted. And the blood vessels, at least a couple of them had webs. We all talked about how it affects the vascular endothelium. So this is like an injury somewhere. The endothelium was damaged and it healed and formed a scar and occluded the pulmonary artery. But again, you can say it's only on two patients, but at least on those two, I can say, hey, probably these are the signs which explain why the patient is not improving his oxygen.
May help really a lot in terms of how we treat these patients early
Absolutely.
On. Probably that's really, I think, what we're hoping for from that data. That's going to be very interesting.
That's all I got for you, Joe.
Excellent. That's all you got for us. That was pretty doggone good.
Excellent.
That wasn't just that's all I got for you. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
That was terrific.
So just as an offhand, University of Washington has a registry. It's actually run by an IDE fellow. They have 1,000 post-solid organ transplant patients. If you want, I'll forward you the link to it. It's a red cap. It's an open access. They published a preliminary 400 patient data. Now they have 1,000 patients apparently, all of them in the United States who had a transplant done, then got exposed to COVID.
Okay.
So if you have anybody, please do add on to it. I think it's a group knowledge to see how people are doing.
Outstanding. Okay. Dr. Samir, would you like to give your update on COVID-19 now?
You sure have time for that? It's a long lecture.
That's entirely up to you.
I
don't make the decision. You are making the decision. I am deferring all of our...
Maybe put in a different program?
We can do whatever you want.
No, I think
if you would like to do it, we can do it.
So it's a long lecture. I'd rather be everybody be fresh for it.
Okay. So you want to delay it.
Sir,
Yes, he wants to do it. You don't understand, Doc. Okay,
he's trying to be nice.
Yes. I want you to say it on camera. May we please delay this for another program?
Absolutely. I mean, really, because I want to ask a few questions of Soma.
We can do that.
Yeah.
Yes, I will do that. We'll have to reschedule, but only if everybody that's currently here agrees to come back for it.
Absolutely.
The only way I'll do it.
I'll have
you bring your wife and kids next time.
I'm bringing the family.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I'll have more info, and definitely I would love to come. And if you are interested in it, show what our CT findings were and what the pathological findings were.
Absolutely. So I'd like to do that. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to do it.
Because I really want to wrap up with some questions.
Can it be within the next 4 weeks?
We'll have to look at it. Yeah. Look at our schedule.
Depending on when it is, Joe. Yes.
Okay. So if y'all will just let me know if you give me some dates that'll work. It could be the weekend, it could be a Saturday, it could be a Sunday, it could be a Monday, it could be a Wednesday.
I'm ready to the first of July.
I'm sorry?
I'm in the fifth of Soma. He is busier than me.
So. Okay, so you tell me when it can happen. So okay. John, I know you have to travel. So,
sorry.
You know, if you guys can just share with me that, we'll make it happen.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
So, just for the record, Dr. Samir has asked
what is wrong with him today?
We could please put off his COVID-19 update, which is a little long of a lecture, he says.
I will have more updates by next time, I'm sure.
And FDA, we'll have more updates.
And my hero, Anthony Fauci, will get more stuff.
And everyone here, Dr. Soma, Serena, John, and Gil have all agreed to come back within somewhere within the next 4 to 6 weeks, 6 weeks being the maximum. We're going to pick some times. Dr. Soma will let us know when he can do it. So we will see you then for that special program that we'll add. Check out our site. We have new programs scheduled already, and we may even take one of those and change it for this. It's just really going to depend. But it's been a pleasure to be with all of you. Again, yes. And what's the problem? Okay. They always do that.
Can I ask a question on air?
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait. Dr. Samir has more questions to ask. Forgive me.
Can you promise to have a lecture for the TMC about lung transplant of COVID-19?
Absolutely. I would love to.
You have to invite us. That is something we really have to invite us.
Absolutely. I would love to.
It's a really a subject that not many people are aware of.
Yeah.
And, you know, I stuck Serena with it because I know she's very smart and she can handle it.
Thanks.
So, we're open to that subject and we want to know about it more because there's a lot of medical legal issues in Africa. And can you include in that DCD lung transplants?
Absolutely.
I mean, because that's a hot topic right now.
That's right.
And how should we give that, should we treat that, the DCD livers or not? So really, it's a very important thing. Okay?
Yeah. Okay.
Dr. Samir, may I give the closing remarks now? Just check.
You know, I'm going to have one last thing since you said that. Yeah. I really want to thank Gil for supporting the ECMO in the Periphery program and helping me a lot.
Yes, well, I was going to thank Gil as well. In fact, on behalf of all of you out there and myself and the crew here, David and Magic, and everybody that's out there right now, I wanted to thank Gil, John, Dr. Samir, Dr. Soma, Serena for being here and doing this absolutely incredibly informative and knowledgeable people. I certainly am very humbled and privileged to be around all of you folks and appreciate you taking your Saturday to come here and do this. And I thank all of you for watching the program. And before I go, Dr. Samir, any final thoughts? Would you like to tell everybody goodbye?
Goodbye. I just want to thank everybody who's really helped us through this very difficult time. I really appreciate it. Please stay safe. And please be, and I think everybody's smart enough to know there's a pandemic coming. So please, flu vaccine. I don't want to see you put you on ECMO because you have flu or COVID. Please don't let that happen.
That's a good thought. Thank you all very much.